Hey, Cliff Ravenscraft here, and in this episode of the Cliff Ravenscraft Show, I want to let you in on a little secret. I launched another podcast, and I launched it back in January of this year, 2024. And I've been publishing an episode of this brand new podcast every single week, and I've not yet told you about it until now. And in this episode, I'm going to share with you our most recent episode, episode number 18, where we go into the topic of the book, The Four Agreements. Now, many of you who have been listening to me for a very long time, you know that The Four Agreements is one of my all-time favorite books, probably in the top five of all books I've ever read. We go deep into this book in a way that I've not gone into in other conversations that I have shared previously in this podcast. So I wanted to bring this episode, episode number 18 of this brand new podcast. By the way, it's called Life, the Ultimate Choose Your Own Adventure Game. And it's hosted by myself and my great friend and one of my favorite people on this planet, Daphne Scott. Daphne has been one of my one-on-one coaching clients for more than a decade, and the kind of conversations that we have, blending ancient wisdom and modern psychology and science and research, bringing it all together about how to create the life that we want to create in this world. We decided that there's just way too many conversations that the two of us have had that needed to be recorded, that we needed to share so much of this message with the world. And so we did launch a podcast. I think it's my 54th podcast that I have produced since I've started podcasting. And it launched back in January. You can find this podcast, by the way, at chooseyourownadventurepodcast.com. It's landing and it lives on Daphne's website. So chooseyourownadventurepodcast.com. Here is episode number 18. We talk about the book, The Four Agreements. If you like what you're about ready to hear, as soon as you finish listening or as you're listening, go look for Life, the Ultimate Choose Your Own Adventure Game podcast. Subscribe today. Go back and listen to the first 17 episodes. And without any further ado, here is Daphne and I speaking about The Four Agreements. Daphne, this is a podcast episode I have been looking forward to having this particular conversation with you for so long about this particular book.
Yes, and me too. And I'm going to tell you, you know, what is so exciting to me about this is I read this book. This was one of the first books I think I read on my, you know, what I would call my beginning of my awakening journey. You know, we could put it in the self-help section. But yeah, it is definitely one of the first books I ever read. And I'm really excited because going back through it, I wouldn't say that I've gone back through it, you know, in the last probably 8 years. I probably reread it maybe 10 years ago. But going back through this time, I mean, just the way things landed differently for me. And then just getting some, there's just this historical context. Like, for example, he mentions Forrest Gump in the book, the movie Forrest Gump. And I went back and I'm like, wow, when did that movie come out? So if you're curious what book we're talking about, stay tuned.
Welcome to Life, the Ultimate Choose Your Own Adventure Game with hosts Cliff Ravenscraft and Daphne Scott. Join this dynamic duo as they explore the profound concept of life as a thrilling adventure, blending ancient wisdom and modern psychology. Embrace the joy of living with presence, creativity, and playfulness. It's time to navigate the game of life together. Are you ready to play? Let the adventure begin.
So, Daphne, this week for me, it was the profound concept of life.
I had the play. Are you ready to play?
I am ready to play. And we're going to be talking about the book, The Four Agreements by Don Miguel Ruiz.
Yes. To end the suspense.
Yes, to end the suspense. I want to say that for me, it would have been interesting to know what it might have been like to have this particular book be the introduction to my awakening journey, because I didn't start out with a very easy book. I started out with Autobiography of a Yogi by Paramahansa Yogananda. And then I went straight into his 2-volume commentary on the scriptures of and teachings of Jesus called The Second Coming of Christ, the revelatory commentary of the original teachings of Jesus. And then I went down some way deep in very esoteric paths. And it was probably about a year into my awakening journey when I finally discovered this one little book I could have read in an afternoon in 2 hours.
Yeah, and easily.
It is so amazing how it simplified things that I had been trying to wrap my mind around, but also in a way that describes everything I'd been experiencing over that past year, going down some much more complex routes.
Yeah, it is. The reason I laughed and you said Autobiography of a Yogi, because he gets in there about how they're levitating and, you know, his guru comes back to him like he's been dead for, you know, however long.
That's what I'm saying. Wow. I'm coming from a lifetime brought up in the confines of the evangelical fundamentalist Christian doctrine, right, of all this other stuff. And I'm feeling compelled and drawn to read this book by Paramahansa Yogananda. And it is literally like, you talk about some resistance to thinking about the world and God and the universe and everything, the concept of life from a different perspective. It was an awakening experience. And at first it was a bit of a rude awakening.
Yeah, it is. That is a steep ramp.
Yeah,
for sure. Well, this book, I mean, I would say, you know, we're saying you could read it in an afternoon, and you can, for sure. I mean, it's not that thick of a book. So The Four Agreements by Don Miguel Ruiz, it's not that thick of a book. However, I will say that some of the concepts, like we're going to touch on this because you mentioned it. We're going to talk about like the idea of the dream of the planet. You know, I mean, there are parts of this book that are definitely, by the way, it's written from his tradition, which is the Toltec tradition, which is the specific group of Indians from Mexico. So this is his background and his culture that he was raised in. And, you know, they do talk about some pretty deep concepts and some different ways. And what I would say are some different ways to think about things. And that's what this book, there are a couple of things that stood out to me when I first read it. And one of the first, I mean, it's called The Four Agreements. And you immediately have the idea that there are four sort of prescriptions he's going to give you for how to, you know, live a much more joyful life. I'm paraphrasing. However, he makes it very clear in the beginning of the book that there are things also that you have agreed to. Unconscious things based on where you were born, who your caregivers were, what things you decide to believe. Like, we could call them beliefs. I think we could change the word agreement to beliefs, and just how this happens in what he refers to as our, being domesticated.
Yes.
Yeah. Our domestication. So this was really eye-opening to me. When I first read this, I was like, what is he talking about? You know, like what? I've agreed to certain things. And, you know, we have other ways people have talked about it is we have these contracts that we have unconsciously signed, right? So to speak. So he really makes that clear, you know, at the top of the book and not really presenting it as necessarily good or bad. However, there are certain things that we take on as beliefs that we may not even recognize that we've been, what I would say, subscribing to that can become very much rate limiting factors for us in our life and can create these limits. So this is really sort of the first part of the book before he gets into the idea of, okay, here are new agreements that you can make with yourself and ways that you can show up that can make your life much more enjoyable and basically not create hell on earth for yourself. And by the way, other people.
Yes.
So, yeah.
So yeah. For me, the book opens up. One of the things that I like about this is he shares the understanding of the original teacher of this. The Smoky Mirror is what he called himself, or she. But anyway, the reality was that in this culture, in this story, this person had been brought up as a medicine man and was going to go and follow this tradition. And this person did not agree with everything he was being taught. And right. So felt called to go off into the wilderness, into the woods, and one night sleeping in a cave, had somewhat of a metaphysical experience, a oneness with all that is kind of experience. Now, for me, I have read a book called The History of Mysticism by Swami Abhijananda. This okay. book is amazing, and it tells the story of practically every major ancient tradition, people group throughout all of history, and how everyone has this experience. Every
culture. Like the going off.
Has the yes
part or the, this or the sort of this moment of oneness,
the moment of oneness.
Okay, yes.
There's in every culture, in every history, in every tradition, there's the mystic who experiences the we are all one.
Yes.
So I love that it started off with that, and of course, I would imagine if this was my first on-ramp into the awakening journey, I might have found myself a little bit resistant to that idea initially because it was against my agreements of just the theology and what does the book of Genesis say compared to this or whatever. And so one of the things that I love is that he does go in and he starts talking about the dream of the planet. He starts talking about the fact that everything is a dream. Everything, if you're hearing us right now, you're dreaming of what we're saying. You're dreaming this. And there's this thing called ultimate reality. But for you to be able to participate in listening to this live stream as we're streaming live or in podcast form later, you had to have made agreements with the English language. Yes. Of what things meant and yes. words meant. So every time Daphne and I are using strings of words to put strings of sentences together to monologue on different topics and things like that, we are taking experience and trying to communicate it to each other through an agreed set of symbols called words.
It's amazing we can have any conversation at all.
And the fact that but we weren't born speaking English. We right. weren't born, nobody was born speaking any particular language, but agreements began to be made to form the ability to communicate.
Well, and even prior to being what I call being languaged, right? Like there was a point in my life where I did not understand any words really, but I understood a lot about how I was, you know, not that I remember any of this, but, you know, how we interact with our caregivers, how we interact with the world at large. You know, there are all of these messages that we're taking on even before we become verbal.
Right. So there, yeah. So what I was getting at is for me, the concept of just the fact that the words that we use
yes.
are beliefs in and of themselves.
Yes, they are. And it's where we get concepts and yes.
Exactly. And I had to become aware of this because oftentimes I'd get into a coaching conversation and somebody would speak a certain set of beliefs and they would use some language, a few words. And my meaning that I associate to those words might be perceived as negative and stuff like that. And I would say, hey, are you sure you want to use that language? And they're like, well, what's the big deal with that language? Well, yeah. Because that word means this. And they're like, no, this word means this. And I'm like, we're not in agreement about the meaning of this word.
Yeah. Which, by the way, is a place that I spend a lot of time. I'm sure it's because of my philosophy background and, you know, words create worlds.
Yes.
And I think, you know, that's what I really took. That's not my quote, by the way. That comes from Chris Peterson, who was a positive psychology researcher. But they do create worlds. And, you know, I think it can be very important to know what we're talking about. I was just writing this article on productivity. And what are we talking about? Like, what does that even mean? Because what it means to you may be very different than what it means to me, you know? And so defining, so I always call it having an, you know, kind of having an operational definition. I want to mark a couple things here. I think it's important for for the context of when this book was written and being able to put it into now. So this book was written in 1997. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how many years that is. What is it? What's 2027 would be like, what, 30 years, whatever the man is, a while ago. And, you know, Cliff, some of the things that we're talking about with beliefs and how we see the world, you know, some of these experiences, like when you talked about the experience of oneness or what would be also called the experience of awe, mm-hmm. it wasn't called that in 1997. And there's a ton of research has happened since 1997 now in neuropsychology. There's actually quite a bit being done at Johns Hopkins around psychedelics, around these experiences that people have that they would not with psychedelics per se, but these oneness experiences. And they're looking at the brain now. They're able to do a lot more now to understand all this and to put some, you know, even more explanation behind it. Then in 1997, it seemed sort of woo-woo and out of nowhere, right? So I really want to mark this because I think this is one of the reasons why I want to get to why this book. We could be talking about any book, right? And why this book. And there's just so much now going back through this book and knowing the time that has passed and what has come forth around our understanding of, you know, living a great life, being who we can be in this, on this planet, creating the dreams for ourselves, taking the opportunities that we have. And some of these experiences that seem so out of left field are being able to be explained more now than ever, which I think is really valuable. So I think this book, I think how we got on this book was, and at least for me, I know it's true, is this book was just very impactful to me at a very, very early stage of my, you know, awakening process, my change process, and realizing that I could create the life that I wanted to create and that I wasn't a victim. This is another part of the book, that I wasn't a victim of my history and of these sort of agreements that I had, unconsciously agreed to.
So right.
I just wanted to kind of mark that and just say like what was happening in 1997 and where we're at now.
You know? I love that. And what I love about that, adding on to what you've said, is that this book was written in 1997 and it may have sounded a little woo-woo at the time. And you're saying there's more science to back it up today, but there's nothing that's said in this book that isn't also written about in the scriptures of the Holy Bible and also the Vedic scriptures of Hinduism.
Yes.
So, and of course, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, this book called The History of Mysticism, it is something that has gone back in every, so this has been around forever. And what I love is that today, science is catching up to tens of thousands of years of tradition.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we see this again and again. I mean, this is really what, you know, when we came up with this show, this is one thing that was so important to me. Is that we were going to bring in, you know, psychology, we were going to bring in science, we were going to bring in the spiritual realm, we were going to bring in all of it.
Oh, and don't forget my favorite phrase in our script that's in the intro, ancient wisdom.
Yes, ancient wisdom.
Thank you. That was excellent. Wisdom.
Yes, ancient wisdom. That was what I was trying to think of. So yeah, we were going to bring in all of it. And I find that all of it has value and all of it is helpful. And I think it's very helpful when we're wanting to talk about things and explain things. And I think, you know, for me, what all of those pieces open up is you start to see these common threads, right? You start to see the commonalities from ancient wisdom to psychology to philosophy to all these different pieces. And you're like, oh, the different spiritual traditions, right? When you get to the root of them, what were they really talking about? So yeah. It's all very helpful. Yeah.
So we talked a little bit about the dreams, that the fact that we're dreaming, yes. The fact that we have agreements are kind of, you can say the word belief for agreement. And so, and by the way, the dream is a made up idea, belief, or thought or concept as well. So that's this whole idea. So we're talking about the dream, and we were talking about the dream of language that we use to communicate with one another. We talk about our own personal dreams. So you were talking about there are certain things that we have in our own unconscious mind that we operate under because we experienced some things before. We then assume this is what this means. We believe that to be true. We made some sort of agreement about what that meant, and we live our life looking through the experience of reality through the lens or filter of this unconscious system or dream that we have.
But it's wild, man.
And then he talks about it's not just our personal dream, but there's the dream of the family. There's the dream of the town, the community. There's the dream of your faith community. There's the dream of your state. We live in the United States, so it's amazing to see some states are very red states or blue states, or some have this and some have that. And so there's very real seeming lines of what people believe in certain people in certain people groups. Then there's the dream of the nation, the dream of the continent, and then there's the dream of the planet. And not just the dream of the planet today, but then there's the mass consciousness of all humanity, which, by the way, that's a different term from something else, not here, but the mass consciousness of all humanity is the dream of all humankind. It's the culmination of every thought, belief, attitude, concept that has ever been created, and it's all out there floating around, informing each other and impacting each other and all this other stuff. And there's arguments that are made that not only are we born and then we start making agreements with what we've been taught, there are arguments that are made that some of that memory, some of those agreements are stored in memory in our DNA, passed down from our ancestors, from our parents, our grandparents, and so on. And I don't know where science lands on this today.
Daphne, it's called epigenetics.
Epigenetics.
It's a real thing.
But the idea that if there was an incredibly physically, emotionally traumatic experience with... And it must have been my grandmother, great-grandmother, great-great-grandmother. Somewhere down in my line, somebody had a vicious experience with a snake. I have no idea what it was. It could have been all the way down to, you know, I'm not going to go there.
It wasn't Eve, was it?
I have no idea. But here's the interesting thing. I have this irrational fear of snakes, Daphne.
Huh.
I've never had a snake do anything bad to me.
Yeah.
Ever. Yep. But if I see a snake on television, I can't look.
I have something to tell you.
I'll listen in just a second. If I see a snake in person, I'm like, oh my gosh. I'm like, my life is in mortal danger. I don't care if it's a little cow snake, black snake. I don't know one snake for another snake. All I know is I see snake and I know instantly that my life is in dire danger. I am going to die if I don't get out of this experience. And that's even if I see a picture of one.
Yeah.
So the interesting thing is I went down to this place called Natural Bridge State Park. It's 2 hours from my home. And there are these beautiful mountains. It is the, what do you call the mountains here? They're the Appalachian Mountains that come through Kentucky. And there's Natural Bridge State Park, and it's in the Red River Gorge area. I've heard about this place my entire life. Never been, ever. My parents always took me 5 hours away to the Smoky Mountains. And so, and I'm a mountain person. I love mountains.
Yes.
Interesting thing. I go to Natural Bridge State Park. This is just as gorgeous. And in some ways, and I happened to go on a fall day when all the colors were out. The different leaves. So in many ways, this was actually more beautiful than anything I've ever experienced in the Smoky Mountains. And I love the Smoky Mountains. And I was ticked.
Really?
I came home and I called my mom. I said, you've got some explaining to do. I said, Mom, why am I 50 years old before I've ever had my first experience in the Kentucky National State Park of Natural Bridge? And she said one word, snakes. That's why.
Because there were snakes there, but none in the Smoky Mountains.
Well, the Smoky Mountains doesn't have those copperhead snakes or whatever.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So you get some sense of where this potentially irrational fear may have gotten.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. I clearly at some level picked it up from my mom, and I'm wondering if it even goes back beyond her Because as far as I know, my mom tells lots of stories about traumatic things, you know, interesting things that have happened in her life. Not once has she ever told me about the time she was bitten by a snake.
Right.
But I know she's terrified of them. And I know I agreed with that terrification. I know that's not a word, but I'm going to make it. I have a terrification of snakes.
I too have a terrification of snakes.
By the way, can we make an agreement that that's a new word in the English language?
I'm going to see how many times I can use it in the show.
All right. So you said you had some things to say about snakes.
Well, I have a very irrational fear. Well, I'm just going to say I have a fear of snakes. Like, I don't know if it's, you know, I guess on one level, I would say that I've never been bitten by a snake. I have come upon snakes and I'm sure they were just as scared as I was. You know, they're just like laying there, minding their own business. And I'm walking through the yard and, oh, there's a snake. So I've had that happen. But I've had that happen with people too. And I don't seem to be as afraid of people. So maybe it is somewhat irrational. I have a similar thing. I also know my mom is not very welcoming to the world of snakes. So, you know, who knows? But I think the take home point that you're making here, very well made an example of snakes, is we take on these things, right? And there's not even a conscious sort of, it's not like you said, oh, my mom is terrified of snakes. Okay, I'm going to be too. I'm going to do the same thing. You just picked it up. And it could have also happened long, you know, your mom got it from someplace else and someplace else. So all of these things are really happening. And, you know, wanting to get underneath all that, this is another part of the book. You know, he describes, he doesn't really get into how to do it per se, but he gets into like making an inventory of these beliefs that you have, which I did at one point in my life. Now, I didn't do it from this book, but what I really looked at is what are the self-limiting beliefs that I have? You know, some of the work, for example, that I did was around money. Like stories that were told and sold, I like to say it that way, that were told and sold about money. It's the root of all evil, right? Like at the same time, I mean,
if you build barns to store up your extra things, then everything you have will be taken from you tonight, which is a parable in the New Testament.
Yes. So, you know, we get these sort of stories and these ideas. One of my favorites is the story about flying too close to the sun.
The Icarus, right?
Icarus, yes. And, you know, it's very interesting that story, we never hear actually the second part of it. They cut it off. So what we typically hear is, Icarus, don't fly too close to the sun. You'll, you know, get burned up, right? But the actual second part of the story that he tells, his father is telling him the story, because he makes these wings for Icarus to fly. The second part of it is, and no matter what, never fly too low. You will, he's telling him not to get too close to the ocean. You will for certain perish. We never hear that second part of it. There's a whole bunch of these stories, metaphors, you know, that we never hear the second part of it. So we start subscribing to these stories, to these ideas, and we use words are the ways that we do it.
I'll give you another one that people subscribe to is, you know what my biggest problem is, Cliff, is I have too many different passions, too many different ideas, all of this other stuff. And the thing is I have so many interests, and my biggest problem is that I'm a jack of all trades and I'm a master of none. And that's my biggest problem. And I need to figure out what can I focus on so I'm known for one thing and one thing only.
For my whole life.
That's exactly what people are coming to me for from time to time. And I said, well, first and foremost, can I introduce you to the entire quote? It's the jack of all trades is the master of none, but is oftentimes better than the master of none.
There you go.
A jack of all trades is oftentimes a better person to work with than one who is not a master of anything.
Yeah, there you go. So we never hear the second part. Interesting.
Until you tune into Life, the ultimate choose your own adventure game with Cliff and Daphne.
I know Stephanie, Daphne. That's a lot of ease in your life. We're going to tell you the truth.
What we agree upon as that truth. Anyway, hey, Daphne, can I read something that is a summary of The Dream of the Planet?
Yes, read that, and then let's get into these four agreements. All right. That'd be great.
So here's what it's... This is a summary. Ruiz explains that the dream of the planet refers to the shared beliefs, myths, agreements, and opinions that make up our human societies and cultures. This collective dream governs how we think and act. We are born into this dream of the planet and taught from a young age how to live, think, feel, and believe according to its rules, concepts, and agreements. Our personal family, school, religion, and society shape how we perceive reality based upon this shared dream. Adults teach children how to dream according to societal norms by hooking their attention and imprinting rules, language, and belief systems onto them through repetition and by rewarding and punishing certain behaviors. This process of domestication trains humans to live according to the dream of the planet. The dream of the planet can be likened to a fog or smoke that clouds our ability to see ourselves and the world clearly. It keeps us trapped in fear, suffering, judgments, and lies that we accept as truth. This shared dream reinforces the idea that it is normal to live in fear, worry, sadness, and scarcity. The first step to personal freedom is to realize that the dream of the planet is just a dream and not necessarily the truth. We must become aware that we have been domesticated and that most of the beliefs that we hold are not even our own. This opens the door to questioning the dream and choosing a different dream, a new dream, a dream of heaven rather than hell.
There we go. And the dream, and I think the take home point from that is really when he starts to make the distinction between fear and love. That fear a and lot love. Of this, yes, fear and love. The way that we've been domesticated quite a bit is, you know, and we can, I mean, you and I have talked about so many of these things on the show already, but we can talk about, you know, the ego and its desire to keep us safe and how we get domesticated into these beliefs about what we can do and what we can't, how we can be and how we can't be.
Yeah.
And so we start, you know, we just start believing these things and none of it is true. Really? Well,
and I know you want to get into the actual four agreements, and I do as well, but I also want to, and I also, see, I caught that one.
And it's so good.
I'm learning. All right. So I also want to bring in something else that I caught this second time through, and it's what he calls the book of law.
Yes. I was just going to mention that. So All of these kind of come together and create this book of law, and we should probably talk about the judge and the victim.
Yes. Let's do that.
Okay. Okay.
So do you want to introduce the book? The law is this concept of everything we believe. This is what governs our thoughts, behaviors, the way we think, and our emotions. Because every time we think against something that we've agreed with, even unconsciously, if we are out of alignment with what we believe, there's a negative emotion that's tied to it. And so what happens is this: we experience punishment. And initially, early on in the domestication process, it was others who disciplined us. It was them who punished us for breaking the book of the law or going against the agreed upon concepts and acceptable things of societal norms. But eventually, we become self-domesticated, meaning that we may have grown up and we're no longer under our parents' roofs. Our parents may not have a lot of influence in the way that we think and see the world and how we process what we're doing day by day as grown adults. Yet we still have that unconscious book of law, and there is the judge and the victim, and I'll let you explain that. But the judge is a part of us. It's a voice in our head that's constantly trying to punish us anytime we go against the book of the law. Go ahead.
Yes. Well, and that's a perfect lead in. Anytime we're going against these rules, we all have these rules, and really to find them, what I would say, and when I work with clients, all you have to do is find your can and can't statements, right? I can work for myself. I can't leave my job. I can make this much money. I can't have that car. I can just keep filling in the blanks. And you will find many of your rules. The other place you find rules is with the big should word, right? When we're shoulding all over ourselves, you'll find your rules. That joke. I love that joke.
And let me give you one other thing. There's a series of questions. Number one, is there anything you want to experience in your life that you're not currently experiencing? Anything. Write it down. All right.
Yes.
Then write down, what are one, two, or three things you already know that you should do that would get you absolutely closer to having that experience? Then write down one, two, or three things that you know you need to put an end to, that if you put an end to them, you would be closer to having that experience in your life. And then for each of those, ask this question: why haven't you already done this? And then for the other questions, why haven't you already put an end to this? And you'll come up with what you have been calling excuses.
Yes.
That's another word for beliefs that are holding you back from experiencing what you most want to create in the world.
Yeah. And let me asterisk this. What I want people to know is they're very logical. They're very logical. There are a lot of very rational reasons that we back into, by the way, for keeping these excuses or keeping these beliefs or keep, you know, they're very rational. What they often are not infused with is wisdom and heart. So it just, you know, and the heart starts calling. And I think that's where we start getting these awakenings, right? You're starting to suffer enough and suffer more and suffer more. And the kitchen is hotter and it's hotter. And then we start to like, what am I doing? So yes, they will all sound very logical.
Yeah, they're logical, but that logic is typically oftentimes based in fear.
It's
like, listen, this is the reason why this is logical, because if you do this, you could experience this very painful thing. And there's a lot of fear about that. Or if I go and do this, what would people say? What would I lose? What if I lose my love and connection with others? What if people judge me? What if people criticize me? What if I lose what I've... So often these logical statements that we back ourselves into, the logic is based in fear.
And
the way that I would say it is, wisdom is always based in love and abundance and joy and peace.
Yes. Yes. Very, very well stated. That's actually what I was getting at, right? So it's very logical, but very rooted in fear. So we have this book of law, and then we have to follow the rules. And if any time that you don't do that, as you mentioned, the judge will come out, and then there's a victim that shows up. There's a part of us that feels at the effect of these rules. And we start playing this game. And by the way, there's another model that was really came out of family dynamics, that was Stephen Cartman. And he came up with this idea of the drama triangle. And it was primarily to look at family dynamics. And he landed on the victim, the villain, and also the hero, which is another character that shows up. But we're going to stay with what Don Miguel Ruiz talks about here, which is the judge and the victim. So we end up in this very strange sort of back and forth with ourselves, where we judge and criticize ourselves. And then when we get tired of doing that, what we do is, I call it taking out the garbage. We project it out into the world. So that guy's over there living his life, doing his thing, having a great time. And all I do is judge him, mm-hmm. because it would break my rule to go do that thing.
Yes.
Or to be that way. And I cannot break that rule. So I'll do that for a while. I start judging, criticizing. And then after a short period of time, I flip it right back on myself. And I start judging and criticizing myself. And then I'll feel like a victim for a little while. I get tired of that. And then and it's just this cycle that keeps going, right? It's a very cognitive, you know, this is when we talked about the cognitive emotional loop. I'll only let myself feel too bad for so long. And then I'll do something to make myself feel really good. Sometimes. And we're going to get into this with the first agreement. That means talking poorly about others.
Yes. And talking poorly to ourselves.
Yeah. And talking poorly to ourselves. Exactly. So all of this starts to, I just want to come back, because I think what you set up really, really was really great around language. This is how these beliefs start to manifest, or how they are. And these rules are manifesting themselves inside of our own heads and in our own conversations and with our own belief systems. So we have the judge and the victim. So you can take a look at your own judger And I think that's another great way to find your rules, right? What do you judge and criticize yourself for? What do you judge and criticize? Sometimes it's easier to see, well, I don't know if it's easier, I guess, but sometimes it's easier to see where we judge and criticize other people, you know, like what we sort of said, but and then get deeper to say like, okay, what do I judge and criticize myself for? Right? Where am I actually kind of holding myself hostage here?
Yeah.
And then you start to find out more of your rules and more of the ways that you're setting things up.
For me to find those judgments, whether it's judging others or judging myself, all I have to do is look for negative emotion.
Yes.
So if I'm feeling angry, if I'm feeling anxiety, worry, doubt, shame, guilt, all of this other stuff, it's typically there's some sort of judgment that I have against another person or of myself, of where I stand. And it's basically out of alignment with what my heart's wisdom, what love would want me to be in the world.
Yes.
But where the book of law has certain agreements that have been made of this is true and this is what it means to actually be in alignment with societal norms. And so I must adhere to this if I'm to be accepted, which is a very logical thing, but still based upon fear. It's still based upon fear when my heart's saying, no, I want to express the authenticity of who I am, the fullest expression of myself, and without being concerned what other people are going to think or say about me.
Yeah, not live in this terrification.
Yes, terrification. Cha-ching! We have one.
And I think just living this at a very deep level in my own life, like I can remember being a teenager and hiding so much who I was, what my sexuality was. Right? Like I wasn't real super clear about it, but even as I got older seeing that, I mean, we've all had different parts of our journey where we have hid out because we want to be accepted or we want to fit in some way, you know, as one example, there are many examples. Now, when I really flip that around, it's easy for me to say, well, I wouldn't be accepted by others. And I wouldn't, you know, all this is kind of the fear that comes out of that. But also there was a part of myself that wasn't accepting myself either.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so when I really come back to the root of what was happening is I was told something by someone and I believed it. And then I took it on as in my book of law.
Yeah.
And it took me a little while to undo that. So, you know, all of this fits into really what we're talking about with this book of law, finding your own rules, I just call them, you know, limiting beliefs, right? Self-limits, just ways that we keep limits on ourselves.
Yeah. And another psychological, it's just your system of beliefs. It is literally a list of beliefs that make up the systematic way that you experience life.
Yeah. Said very simply. So great. We've diagnosed sort of what's going on. What do we do about it? And this is where in the book, he gets right at it with these four new agreements that you can take on if you so choose. And he makes no bones about it that they are not easy, which I think is great. They are, I would call them four, you know, practices probably in the beginning, you know. So the first one he talks about, and I love it. Again, I'll say a little bit more about other spiritual traditions here, but he talks about be impeccable, very specific word.
Yep.
Be impeccable with your word. So right now we're right at the language.
Yeah. And right? Matter of fact, he even says, listen, let me tell you, what does the word impeccable mean? And it's literally translated without sin. So whatever you do with the words that you speak and or think, do not sin. Don't miss the mark. Your words create worlds. Your words create reality. Your words have... There's a scripture in the Bible, Daphne, that says that the power of life and death rolls off the tongue.
Wow. That's true. I find.
In my experience, it's been true as well. So be impeccable with your word. What are some things that stand out for you there?
Well, one of the things that I wanted to sort of bring up is that in the Buddhist tradition, the purification of speech is the first one.
Oh,
in terms of what they teach you, it's one of the first practices. because they too recognize that words, and by the way, both, so we're kind of touching on this, not only the words that I speak outward, but the way that I'm talking to myself, right? Like, yes, they are talking about the outward expression and how we're using language and, you know, talking to others. Are we speaking from fear or are we speaking from love? Absolutely matters. Also, this narrative that starts going on in our head really matters. How we're speaking to ourselves, what we're listening to, in, you know, I'm going to say inside of our own heads, who knows where it is, but what this kind of rhetoric is that starts going through our head. And then where that starts to cause suffering. And I mentioned earlier that one of the ways that we keep that suffering going is one of them, and this is one of many, but one in particular that he points out in the book is gossiping. Talking poorly of other people. It's a, you know, a lot of reasons that people do it. And there's tons of research on this, but at the end of the day, I think what's true is that we do that to release our judgment and our criticism of other people and to elevate ourselves in some way, to make ourselves feel a little bit better by demeaning or diminishing someone else. So, you know, being very clear about our word and that words then hypnotize. And actually, this is a conversation that you and I had had at one point, I think before one of our shows. It's probably buried in our archive, in our 18-show archive already. But, you know, that words can, because when I said they create worlds, they can become a way that we get hypnotized, right? What we're listening to every day. You know, am I listening to the endless news cycle and the same stories repeated over and over? I mean, there's no way that you can avoid taking that on in your consciousness.
Well, and I talk to some people that occasional, just, you know, this is such a horrible world we live in.
Yes, I've heard that too.
I hear that quite frequently.
We're more divided than ever.
Yeah, exactly. So those sorts of things. I wanted to go back to one thing that you said earlier, and that is this idea of gossip. One of the things that really resonated with me as I went through this time in reading the book again is the concept that he calls it, it's a form of emotional poison.
Yeah.
Even if what we're saying about others is true, mm-hmm. going out, and it is so true, because what I've experienced is I hate that this has been my experience. I'm aware of it and I'm working to process this. But occasionally there will be certain people in my life that will speak negatively of someone else. This is, oh, this person does this. Oh, this person does this. This person does this. I may not be contributing to the conversation. I'm just hearing it.
Yeah.
Now, all of a sudden, for the very first time, I'm meeting this person face to face. And already judging every word coming out of their mouth based upon the filters of the poison that I've heard spoken about them.
Yes. Yes. And he makes this point very clear in the book. I mean, what choice do you have in a sense that you've just been, this has just gone through your filtering system, right? You've taken it into some degree. And now you're sort of standing there and being like, well, what's my experience going to be with this person? Maybe that person did have, I mean, who knows what their motivation is? Maybe they did have a horrible experience with that person. But now it's been a little bit of a setup. And now there's doubt. Which, by the way, doubt lives right above the core experience of the hardcore fear.
Yeah.
Just right. So now there's doubt. So now you're already entering into this interaction with a little bit of trepidation.
Well, and not only that, but the reality is that person, you said they may have had a negative experience with this person.
Sure.
What they had was an experience with that person.
Yeah.
Which they interpreted as negative. And
yes,
that's
yes.
the filter of what they gave us. So,
that's right.
So it may have, that person may have not even meant what they heard or perceived. They may have said something, or they may have had a little bit of an attitude because of something happened right before they walked into the office or whatever, and stuff like this. But you perceived it that they were making an attack on you. Clearly, if you looked at it from a bunch of different angles and watched instant replays and all this other stuff, you could right. come up with other meanings. But here, you know, the people that you gossip to are only hearing your perspective, your right. perception, your this. And if we could just be aware of the fact that, wait a second, when somebody comes and gossips to me, I don't want to agree with it. I want to not come to a conclusion about the truth of such statements.
And, you know, I think that's beautiful. And I want to say a word about this because I too have, I mean, I don't know anyone on the planet who has not gossiped or not had many experiences with gossip, whether you're listening to it or you're the one verbalizing, it doesn't matter, by the way, you're still a part of the system. So, you know, what I think I started and it's still a practice for me to this day, what I started to pay attention to was how I felt, because there's another thing that gossip, it is absolutely born of some level of fear, and there's a little adrenaline hit that comes with it. And I started to pay very close attention to how I feel in my body when either I'm listening to gossip or when I am the one gossiping or both. I mean, it's the same thing. When I'm involved in any sort of gossip quagmire, how I started to feel. And I can confidently tell you that I feel tired after I have been involved in a conversation like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, the adrenaline has been flowing. There's, you know, again, there's a million reasons for it. It creates a false sense of connection with the person you're talking with. And there's just so many other things that could be more life-giving to talk about, probably, you know, all things being equal. So I think if we pay attention to how we feel too, it helps us be able to have some boundaries around it. Because I think that's one of the hardest things. And most people, when I've worked with them, it's like, yeah, but how do I remove myself from these situations? Like, I don't want to agree with this person. You said it perfectly. I don't want to agree with what they're saying with. I don't want to keep the conversation going. I'm at work. I'm in a group of 3 or 4 people. We're all gossiping. There's some connection. How am I possibly going to make myself the odd man out here and shut this down, so to speak? And I think once people start paying attention to how they really feel, it becomes a little bit easier to shift the conversation. It becomes a little bit easier to, you know, excuse yourself and go to the bathroom, whatever you need to do to exit the conversation. Or if you shall be so bold to say, hey, I noticed this conversation doesn't feel very good to me. Can we switch the topic? You know, without forming judgments about the other people or pointing fingers or anything like that, or even using the word gossip, right?
Yep.
So yeah, I think that's the other side of this, is just paying attention to how we feel when it's happening too.
One of the things that comes to me as I think about being impeccable with my word, this stood out to me the first few times I read the book and also this time through, is I have a desire to be very intentional about, number one, having less opinions.
Yeah.
That's one thing that I'd like to have less of in my life.
Okay.
And if I do have opinions, I'd like to share them less. I'd like to
keep them to myself.
Hold on a second. If anyone knows anything about me, I love to talk.
Yeah, all right? Me too.
I love to create content. I love to speak, and I love to share my ideas and stuff like this. But one of the things that I want to do less is I want to stop speaking my opinions. Instead, what I'd love to do is invest more time, percentage-wise, speaking about my experiences, my perceptions of how I'm filtering things, how it's impacting me, you know, evaluating whether or not I feel this is a beneficial way to experience this, and based upon where I am, what do I want to create from this, and leaving out the part of the stories where I may be perceiving that I'm some sort of victim in any situation or scenario, or somebody has done something, and occasionally somebody will come to me and say, hey, Cliff, what do you think about so-and-so, or what do you think about that situation? And I'm like, I really am trying not to think about that.
Yeah. Well, I actually think you do a great job sharing, you know, life through your experience.
Yeah.
So I don't know where else you're sharing your opinions, but.
No, I only in private mostly.
Yeah.
But yet I occasionally, somebody once said, hey, Cliff, what do you think about such and such? Or what do you think about so-and-so? And it was somebody we all knew. And I have all sorts of inside knowledge that most people don't have knowledge of. And I didn't say anything spiteful, hurtful, or poisonous. But I did speak an opinion, right? Mm. And my opinion was based upon details that I'm familiar with. But I still understand that my opinion is still run through my unconscious beliefs about what's right and wrong and what values I hold and all this other stuff. And so my opinion is not, it's not completely non-toxic, if you know what I'm saying.
I do. I mean, I think anytime, I really appreciate what you're saying, because I think when we talk about being impeccable with your word, when someone's asking you to give an opinion about another human being, I mean, good luck. People, first of all, people are incredibly complicated. You know? I'm like, well, I can write you a book on this person's life if you like, from my perspective.
Let me give you a real, it's like, okay, Cliff, I'm about ready to invest $50,000 to work with so-and-so. Do you think that this is a good investment? And mm-hmm. I'm like, wow, I really like you. I really like this person. Mm-hmm. I happen to know what you want, and I happen to know what this person is promising you. I happen to know all sorts of details about this person that most people don't know. And if mm-hmm. they knew them, they might not want to hire them to help them do what you want to do. And at some point, at some level, I'm like, well, who am I to have that opinion? You know, I think at some level it's non-toxic. It's not, you know, somebody's coming to me for my thoughts and stuff like this, but it's based upon my perceptions of a situation, a scenario, and there's countless data, billions of forms of data that I'm unfamiliar with in that person's life and scenario, and this may be the best thing for them to go do. And here I am asked to give an opinion on whether or not this person should invest $50,000 to work with this person.
Well, and I think in that scenario, you know, I guess we could pretend that it's personal about the person, but I think in that scenario, this person saying, I'm going to invest $50,000 to get results. Do you feel I will get results? And I think at that point, you know, it's sort of like, well, look, people have probably, you know, I don't know if you will. And I can't comment on every single instance in which this person has worked with another person to get said results. So it may be beneficial for you to really talk to other people who have worked with this person, because I'm imagining, and I could be wrong, but in this scenario, I am imagining that person you're being asked about, you have not worked with that person and given them $50,000 to get a certain result.
This is true.
So you wouldn't really be able to comment. I mean, I think that's probably the conflict. Like, you know their backstory, and you may know that maybe they have taken two or three people's money and they haven't gotten results for them. But you wouldn't be able to comment on the experience of them doing the work with people to get those results.
That's right. I don't know what's happening on the other side of the story and any of those scenarios. And what I'm getting at is I'm trying to get to the place, and those conversations don't come up very frequently, but when they do, I feel like they bring me dangerously close to not being impeccable with my word.
Yeah, I hear that.
That's what I'm getting at. And occasionally I find that the opinion flows before the thought of the fact that I'm actually answering something. And it's usually afterwards, and it's like, ugh. And then I'm writing an email. Hey, do you have time for a 5-minute FaceTime call? Because I want to share with you. Let me explain to you that I don't have all the details. And I'm like, maybe I shouldn't have said this. And I don't, and it's not that I feel guilt or it's just that just didn't feel right. I don't feel good.
Yes.
About this. I'm not feeling guilt. I'm not feeling shame. But what I just did was not in alignment with how I desire to be in the world. I desire to be impeccable with my word. And I wasn't. I shared some level of toxicity in my response about another person.
Yes. Yes. And that is always a slippery slope.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I agree. So I agree with you on the opinions. I love to talk as well. I am at no lack of opinions on anything. So letting go of that here and there is always a worthy endeavor. Okay, so being impeccable with that word. Number two, I want to move to this. Take nothing personally.
I love this.
My favorite. This one, I should have highlighted this in my notes too, because this was one that was a really big aha moment for me when I first read this book. It makes sense. It's logical. So if I'm with all the things that we've just said, if I'm running around here in my own little world with my own little constructs and my own ideas about how the world works and what should happen and what shouldn't, and my own book of my own rules and laws, How in the world can my judgments or what I think have anything to do with you, Cliff? It's really very logical. It's logical of like, why am I taking this so personally? Of course this person sees the world the way they see it.
Yeah.
Of course they have their own perspectives. Of course. And of course, at times what I'm doing over here on Planet Daphne is not going to fit in with their book of rules.
Planet Daphne. I love it. Daphne, I want to tell a story related to this. So I have some folks and one person in particular who has lots of criticism of things that I do.
And
at one point, as you know, I do the Day with Cliff package.
Wait, hold on. I need to say one person.
Well, one person likes to do this a lot. So
Okay.
It's become more than a hobby for this individual. So anyway, I had this desire. I used to go to Social Media Marketing World every single year, spoke there for seven years straight. And I would always go an extra day early or an extra day late so I could have an entire day walking through the San Diego Zoo all by myself. And I would listen to an audiobook that day.
Okay.
Well, it was in 2020, and I decided, what if I gave somebody an opportunity to have a one day of mentoring with me, walking by my side all day long for 8 hours through the San Diego Zoo?
Oh my gosh, how fun.
Exactly. And so I'm thinking, you know, this is going to be great. I'm going to tell everybody about it and say, listen, here's the thing. If you come and spend a day in my office, at the time I would charge $15,000 to come spend the day with me. But here I'm going to allow this one day of one-on-one mentoring for $5,000. So I put this out all of a sudden, and here's what I wrote. I journaled about this. You will often be criticized by others. I'm happy to report that I am a fully recovered former people pleaser. I chose to learn the hard way that no matter how much effort I put in, I'll never be able to make everyone love me. Mm. I have discovered these five things. The first one, how I am perceived by another person is 100% controlled by that other person's model of the world. It is their beliefs about life and how it ought to be that determines their reaction to the things I do or say. Number two, another person's judgment about what I'm doing or saying is a reflection of that person's beliefs and their values, and it is not a reflection of who I am as a person. Number three, I can't put off living my own dreams just so that other people will not feel inadequate around me.
Mm.
The next one is the fourth item. There is no value in shrinking back from creating the life I feel called to live. And the fifth thing that I learned is that moving forward with my own dreams, in spite of the potential criticism, judgment that might and judgment, it might just encourage and inspire others that they have the power to turn their dreams into reality, freeing them from the fear of how they might be perceived by others. And yes, by the way, I was judged publicly. I got a one-star written review in my podcast on Apple Podcasts, and here's what it says. It's titled, "A Ride into Ego and Overpricing." It says, "Cliff used to be informative and helpful on a journey to establish a podcast, but he threw that entire business model out the window in order to copy the Tony Robbins business model. I'd call him the poor man's Tony Robbins, but when he wants $5,000 to hang out with him in the San Diego Zoo for 8 hours or $15,000 to work one-on-one with him in his home in Kentucky, you quickly get the feeling that Cliff has fallen into a self-absorption fueled by an ego that few will rival."
Wow.
Yeah. And but here's what I love is that the four agreements was something that I read way before this experience happened. And the four agreements was really helping me come into a greater understanding of this the fact that I am this is not personal.
Yeah.
And the fact that the second agreement, don't take anything personally, has been the most influential agreement that I've adopted. I literally don't care what anybody thinks about me. I don't care what anyone says about me. Yet I say that And Daphne, I still will tell you that sometimes I'm very self-conscious about putting forth the best image of what I am and holding high standards for the content that I create. And I don't want to just do this and this, this, because I don't want people to perceive me in a different way. And so while there's still a desire to have high levels of production value and a commitment to a standard of what, not of quality.
Yeah.
But yet at the same time, I will say that I still struggle with this idea that if I put out anything less than what's my standards, that somehow in some way I'll be judged by somebody as not as credible in their mind. And there's a fear in some way that that might harm me potentially financially when it comes to a business-faced podcast like the Cliff Ravenscraft Show. So it's even there that it's like, at one level, I really don't care. And at another level, I still have a lot of fear about this.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I mean, I think I want to say a few things. One, you know, there can be a little bit of a nihilistic idea around or consciousness that can come with this idea of don't take things personally. I want to talk about feedback for a second.
Okay.
So what this person, when they wrote this criticism, there wasn't anything there that wasn't helpful, right? It wasn't like, hey, you know, maybe change your website color, or, you know, it was all just vitriol. So, and even if they said something about your website color, it's an opinion, right? So one of my friends had this phrase and he said it this way. He said, if someone calls you a horse's ass once, blow it off. If someone calls you a horse's ass twice, you know, maybe pay attention. If someone calls you that three times, go get a saddle. What he was pointing to. And what he was getting at was, you know, one, and you said that there's this one person who likes to, you know, sort of do this thing. And one person sort of criticism really, in my opinion, doesn't carry any weight.
Right.
If I were getting valuable feedback from people who cared about me, you know, like I trust you as one of my go-to guys in my life. If I come to you and I do ask for your opinion, right? Hey, what do you think about this? And typically it's not about people, but what do you think about this thing? What do you think about this color scheme? What do you think about this font? What do you think about this idea? You have a voice of experience over there. You have wisdom around things, right? That's a very different, and I know you have my best interests at heart.
Yes.
I would trust you and do emphatically. So that is a very different, I know you have your group of guys that you work with, you know, you trust them to give you feedback that's helpful for your growth and your development. When we talk about taking things, and even then, you're not taking it personally. You're listening to their feedback and you're looking at, okay, these are people with experience and they have wisdom and that sort of thing. I recognize also it is simply their opinions that I'm asking for.
I love that. Daphne, there's a proverb in the Old Testament of the Bible that says this: plans fail for lack of counsel, but with many advisors, they succeed. But do you know what that doesn't say?
What?
It doesn't say plans fail and for lack of counsel. It doesn't say that they succeed when you follow the advice of all of your advisors. It's just saying, listen, if plans fail because you've sought nobody's wisdom, nobody's advice, nobody's opinion.
Yes, right.
But if for plans to truly succeed, get some other perceptions of the situation outside of your own. And as many as you can add that come from wisdom and experience and knowledge, get those, gather those, and then make your own decision.
Yes. So I used to get feedback when I was leading teams. It was called stop, start, and continue. And I would have them fill out just this very simple document. Tell me what I should stop doing, tell me what I should start doing, and tell me what I should continue doing. Now I had to be very mindful, and you know, I worked with a team of people where these weren't anonymous, so their names were on it. And it was incredibly helpful because I could see the things that were themes, that were threads throughout. For example, one time I got feedback, this was so long ago, one time I got feedback, don't pull your phone out when we're in one of our meetings. A, very simple to handle. And B, that showed up three times
from a team of six people.
Right. So was there a theme there?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, there was. And three people said it. And I'm like, okay, noted. And then there were also...
I just want to say there, I want to point out, I like the fact, the distinction between that and the horses asks the phrase, is that's three different people who gave you the same feedback.
Yes. Yes.
It doesn't mean as much to me if the same person gives you the same feedback three times.
Right. And here's the great part of it. Other themes, ask more questions, right? I would come in with my ideas and my opinions and how I thought it should be done, right? So ask more questions. Great. Here's what was beautiful about certain things, though, where there was a theme from one person, I was learning about that person and what they needed.
Yep.
Right. So one of my managers said, please don't just pop into the office unannounced and expect me to be able to talk to you. In other words, they had their day going on. I would just show up on my rounds. I was living in Chicago at the time in the city, and I'd pop in and be like, hey, everybody, you know, hey, let's have a chat. And she's looking at me like I am in the middle of 15 different things, right? We would have a scheduled meeting time later, but not at that moment. And that bothered her. Now here I thought from my world over here that I was being spontaneous and letting this person know that I cared about them and their office and what they were working on and what they were doing. I was taking time out of my day to just pop in and say hello. That was not appreciated. No other manager said that, but that person did. That didn't work well for them.
Right.
So you get to learn about what that person needed and how they wanted to be interacted with too. I still stopped by the office. I just didn't expect them to, you know, take a time. We made that very clear. So, you know, you got to learn then very specific what people needed. So Anyhow, I just say all that because I think and by the way, still none of it was personal.
Right. Exactly.
Still none of it was personal. Right.
It was their personal. Feedback. Exactly. It was personal to them. It was, this is what they need.
Yes.
This isn't how I should be. This is what they need. Now, the question is, do I want to be the type of leader that is able to give my team members what they need?
Exactly.
And getting that feedback is incredibly powerful. And I do agree. There's something incredibly valuable about receiving feedback and constructive criticism. It's easier to take when you've asked for it.
Sure.
but even when not asked, you know, there's even value oftentimes in the toxic, you know, criticism and feedback and stuff like that. Even if it was said with lots of vitriol, I will tell you this one individual, oftentimes if he starts up a new email address so that he can email me and get past my filters.
My gosh.
Yeah, it's a thing, Daphne.
He has a lot of time.
He has lots of time because I record lots of content and he listens to it all.
I was gonna say that's a lot.
And I think he transcribes it all and everything. But anyway, I digress. Here's what I will say is oftentimes I feel like this emotional attachment to what's being said is because oftentimes it's like, wow, he's mirroring back to me a lot of judgments I have about myself and a lot of my own insecurities right now. And that's why I'm taking this so personally. It's because he's actually externalizing the thing that's been going on in my head.
Yes, that's exactly it.
And in that way, I am so incredibly thankful for this guy to make me consciously aware that I've been holding these judgments against myself, and they're bold-faced lies. For example, you know, we talked about going to the gym and working out 6 days a week, losing all this weight, and then all of a sudden, throughout the pandemic, some of those routines came and went, and then things happened, and it's like, wow, I have been holding that judgment against myself, and these are not very nice words that are in this email, but man, every time I put on a shirt and I'm getting ready to go out into a conference since 2020, those exact words are what I've been saying to myself.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I'm ready to be done with them.
Yes. Ready to let go of that. Not helpful.
Can I? Yeah. We'll probably need to wrap up and do a part two of this one. But definitely one last thing I definitely want to put in here is I pointed out this one note, praise and criticism. Just as you shouldn't internalize criticism, you shouldn't base your self-worth on the praise of others because both can be traps.
Yes. Oh, I'm so glad you said that, because we've talked about sort of the, you know, what could be perceived as negative. And I'm telling you the positive, and we definitely should bookmark this, because I want to talk about ambition.
Yep.
On our next show. And we'll continue with this and taking the praise personally.
It's like dopamine hits. It's like, oh my God, it's like the TikTok, you know, it's like, hey, yes. I'm just waiting for my next praise. I'm just waiting for the next attaboy. I'm just waiting for that next person to tell me that they love me, that something I did changed their lives. I'm looking for that next thing that somebody will say that I am worth existing on this planet.
Please give me another thumbs up on my social media account.
Exactly. Even today, Daphne, I know these things, and I publish content. I put it out on Facebook, and I'm like, hey, it's been 15 minutes. I wonder if anybody's liked it and commented yet.
It is.
Who cares?
We are definitely going to do part two on this, because it's, you know, and again, more and more has come out about this too. I have quite a bit to say on this topic.
And we'll talk more next week. Hey, calls to action. What is your call to action this week?
Yes. So if you are interested in coaching with myself, you can email, especially if you are a leader in an organization. I typically work with people who are working in organizations. In other words, you're working for someone else. So that's really where I spend my time. That's absolutely where my area of expertise is. And you're stuck and you would like some additional support, I am happy to have a conversation with you. You can contact me at daphne@daphne-scott.com and shoot me an email and just put in the subject line, coaching, and I will get back to you. And again, especially if you are a person who's felt a little burned out, you have felt that you really can't get it together, you feel like you're not able to be productive in your work life, I want to spend some time with you and show you some tools and get to know you a little bit better.
Awesome. I love it. And my call to action is almost identical to that, different email address. But if you are full-time self-employed as a business owner and you find that you have achieved way more than you ever dreamed possible 10, 20 years ago, you've hit so many different goals and so many different milestones, and by now you would think, I should be fully satisfied, completely fulfilled. But I still struggle with anxiety, fear, overwhelm, imposter syndrome at this point in my life. And I somehow feel like one day this could all fall apart and I'll lose everything. Have you ever experienced those things? If so, I know a lot about them, have helped a lot of business owners. I would love to coach you. So if you want to work with me as a coach, as a full-time self-employed business owner, email me. My email address is cliff@cliffravenscraft.com. Put coaching in the subject line, and I would love to work with you.
Beautiful.
Awesome.
All right. Part two coming next week.
Many blessings, everybody. Until next time, we encourage you to choose your own adventure.